For the House Revenue Committee, and welcome everybody here today. I'm sorry we're starting on a short list of committee members in attendance, but we will go ahead and open at least a public hearing to get started and then move as quickly as we can through our agenda. Let's start with a public hearing on SJR 7. What do we need for that? Is that Liz? No, is that Steve? No, it's Dick. Okay, yeah. Good. Open a public hearing on SJR 7. Dick, if you'd give us the background on that, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Richard Yates with Legislative Revenue. Current law essentially, Mr. Chair, requires a dollar-for-dollar match when bonds are issued under Article 11G of the Constitution for either universities or community colleges. The amendment before you would allow $3 in bonds to be issued for each dollar of general fund matching revenue. All it does is to change that matching requirement.
Okay. And as I'm trying to count here, did we get all the members of the Revenue Committee as co-sponsors on this bill? It looks like we might very well have. No, not all. I don't see Representative Williams. Okay, we have the Chancellor, Dr. Jarvis. Good to see you this morning. And President White, good to see you.
Good to see you, sir.
Welcome. Who wants to start?
I will, if I may.
Chancellor, you bet.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Richard Jarvis, Chancellor of the Oregon University System, and thank you for the opportunity to speak with you this morning on SJR 7. As you know, if the legislature refers and the people approve, SJR 7 would amend the Oregon Constitution. We are requesting this change because since the passage of Ballot Measure 5 in 1990, the OUS has received only $9.6 million in general fund match for the construction of only six projects in that period of time. All the rest of the projects approved by the legislature, and they amount to some 14 in number, were advanced only because campus leadership was able to secure other funds. The other funds are primarily gifts, federal funds, and other non-general fund and non-tuition campus incomes. Transfer of responsibility for development of the match from the state to the OUS campuses has resulted in continued delay of needed educational facilities, library, lab, classroom, computer and tech centers, student support services for a rapidly growing student enrollment. If the amendment is approved, only the match requirement would change. All of the other statutory regulations and safeguards will remain in place. That is, still got to go through development of campus master plans, still got to have State Board of Higher Education review and approval of those plans, still have approval of and submission of the capital construction budget by the governor, legislative review, amendment, and approval of the capital construction budget, legislative approval of the bond budget bill, allowing the sale of the bonds authorized. And campuses would have to secure the match for the bonds authorized if the legislature appropriates no general fund for this purpose. And lastly, the debt service on the bonds sold is charged against the general fund appropriated for the OUS operating budget each biennium. So all of the accountability remains fully in place. The process remains fully in place. We believe the result of the passage of SJR 7 will be a more manageable campus match threshold, timely construction of needed educational facilities, and better service to the growing demand for quality higher education by Oregonians. We'd greatly welcome your continued support of this measure.
Thank you very much. Chancellor, President White, why don't you go ahead, and we'll see if there are any questions of the committee.
Chairman Satterley and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tim White. I'm the president at Oregon State University. And although I'm the sole president here today, I'm speaking for all seven campuses who have provided the unanimous support for this measure. And for the record, not only my testimony, but the testimony of all seven plus the chancellor is in front of you. As you've learned, during the last decade, a very small amount of general fund has been used for construction. And as one example, at Oregon State, we're building currently a $45 million building, the Kelly Engineering Center. It has $20 million in bonds and $25 million in private giving to make that happen, 20 of which came from a single donor, Martin Kelly. It is it is a great treat to have a person of Martin Kelly's caliber donate that level of funds to a building, but it is also infrequent for all the campuses, particularly the smaller ones, to have that level of giving. And the cost of construction for the kinds of buildings we need, as the Chancellor referred to, in terms of laboratories and libraries and lecture halls and the like, really mean that these projects are often large in their overall cost. So this SDR 7 would, as you know, change the match from 1 to 1 to 1 to 3. And there are five bullets I'd like to make for you. First of all, I think passage of this measure would lever more private investments in the universities with respect to capital facilities. And so donors would know that for every dollar they donated, there would be $3 being leveraged from financing. So their impact would be greater. Secondly, I think it would encourage more donors to donate for capital projects at the university. And that's a really important thing in this era. And in private conversations with many of the best friends of Oregon State University, they're quite enthused about what this would mean to them personally and what it would mean to their colleagues who are able to donate significant dollars if it was a 3-to-1 rather than a 1-to-1. But also, as we compete at Oregon, in the state of Oregon and at Oregon State University nationally, is we have to be competitive with our facilities to those that are around the country and indeed in some circumstances around the world. And our facilities are falling behind. I came here from the University of California a few years ago, where the level of facilities and infrastructure is really much more profound than we are able to do here. And so if we want to attract the best faculty and students, we need to be able to attract the very best facilities to allow them to do their creative work. We'll not send state or the system into an abyss of debt. You will always have the authority to determine how much debt Oregonians will have in a given biennium. And as you know, my final bullet, that we've, compared to other states, have been quite conservative in the amount of debt we've taken on as a state and directed most of our resources to operations. And so you will retain that control and authority as well, you should. So for all the right reasons, I encourage your support of this measure. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Are there questions for either Chancellor Jarvis or President White? All of you co-sponsors sitting up here at the desk. Okay. Representative Williams, you are the only member of this committee that's not a co-sponsor on SJR 7. Do you have any questions for me?
How do I get my name on the measure if it's such a good idea? How did I miss it? And why didn't you guys come by and ask me?
You must have been gone that day.
I must have.
All right. Okay, I think we're ready to roll. Thank you very much. Are there anybody else wish to testify on SJR 7? Now my question, maybe for staff, Dick. This has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
It does.
Why? It's not a special election. It goes on the general fund, general election ballot, so there would not be any election costs except for whatever the cost might be attributable to pages in the voter's pamphlet. But
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I can only speculate.
Do you want to, before we go into work session on this, do you want to take a couple minutes to see if LFO
really wants it.
Yeah. Okay. Otherwise, I'd just soon rescind the subsequent and send it straight to the floor.
Okay.
Thank you. With that, we'll close the public hearing.
Thank you.
SJR 7. But we'll come back to it before the end of the meeting. Okay. You mean 2368. Let's do... Who's 230, Madison? Is that you? Okay. Let's do open the public hearing on Senate Bill 230. And good morning, Madison. While you're talking about that, let's invite John Phillips to come on up.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Oh, and also, Madison, before you start... Committee members, you will note that, as promised, we do not have coffee this morning, although staff was kind enough to provide us with some instant coffee packets that I've put on top of the water cooler. There is a hot water tap, so if you really get desperate, help yourselves. All right, Madison, go ahead.
Desperate remedies for desperate measures.
Okay, now we're really interested in Senate Bill 230.
Mr. Chair, I understand they'll be serving MREs in the lounge for lunch today.
Used.
Well, good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mazamatic Legislative Revenue Office. Senate Bill 230 came to you from the Senate side, passed the Senate Revenue Committee and the floor. It got amended in the way, so it's a 230A engrossed at this point. It originally came from the Department of Revenue, and what this Senate bill attempts to do basically are three different things. The first one is gives the Department of Revenue the ability to reduce or change the penalties and the late fees for the centrally assessed properties, which are utilities, and differentiate or be able to give that kind of differentiation for first-time late filers and so on. The second issue the bill deals with is change the fee structure for penalties for the industrial properties, which are also done by the department. The industrial properties are assessed. Those are the big properties of $1 million or more. The fee or the late fee or late filing penalty that is assessed at this time, as current law does, is $1 per thousand for the maximum of $250. This is not the same fee that you would see on the utilities side. So this bill pushes that fee ladder up to be in conformity with the utility late fees. That goes to $10 per thousand up to $5,000. And finally, the third issue this bill deals with is put a rule-making ability with the Department of Revenue for reduction of fees and ability to write rules to do that. Mr. Chair, with the second issue, which is about the fees, and also the third and the first, we have two sources of revenue impact for this bill. The first one would be in relaxing the rules somewhat of assessing the penalties and ability to waive that or reduce it will bring down the amounts that are coming from those penalties on the tune of about $180,000 a biennium. However, on the second issue, which increases the penalties for the industrial properties to be in line with utilities, and again going from $1 per thousand to $10 per thousand up to the $5,000 maximum, we think there'll be about 500 cases a year, and that will end up generating on the tune of about $4.6 million a biennium. Of course, the pluses and the minuses take from each other to get to about $4.5 million a biennium.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mazen. John Phillips, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. The issue with this bill for the department is compliance, and Section 1 talks about compliance for centrally assessed properties. For centrally assessed properties, properties like utilities, transportation companies, electric companies, gas companies, the Department of Revenue appraises these companies. We rely on reports from them as to what their property is. So this is what we're processing and determining the value of the company. And we've had some pretty good success with their turning in these reports. And so the compliance issue with them is how can we improve compliance over what we already have, and that is rather than having a hammer that hits them at $10 per thousand up to $5,000 penalty for everyone, regardless of whether they're one day late or they never file, this would enhance our ability to increase the success by sort of weighing the penalty based on the severity of the non-filing. And so this would give us the ability to reduce or waive the penalty. We already have the ability to waive it, but this would give us the ability to reduce it in cases where, you know, it makes sense to us that this is not a, you know, an intentional, flagrant kind of disregard for the filing deadlines. The Dash 1 amendments on the Senate side actually put a little bit more framework around that, and it said that it clarified in the statute that be maybe we would take into consideration in our rule writing the first-time offense for an act that would help enhance the voluntary compliance. So that's what Section 1 does. Section 2 deals with a different type of property that we also appraise, and those are large industrials. These are industrials that are $1 million or over, and they're more complex. The department appraises them. And the filing fee, late filing for those types of situations are $10 per thousand up to $250. And what happens, we find, is that we have a March 1st deadline, and we have an April 15th extension that they can request, and we grant typically. We have 25 appraisers with 1,200 accounts and $16.5 billion of value, and we're trying by July 1st to get all these returns evaluated, the values determined for the year, and to the county assessors by July 1st. It's a huge process, and when we're dealing with a lot of companies that don't file or file late, then we're contacting the company, we're talking to the tax rep, we're trying to get the data, and sometimes what we end up doing is we end up asserting a value. We don't know whether the value is correct. We're making assumptions about what they had last year, and so it's very nebulous as to what that value really is. Two things can happen. One, we're too high. We guess too high, in which case they appeal, and then we both are involved in an appeal. If they're correct, then there's a refund, which affects the county. On the other hand, if we're too low, they've just made a business decision potentially to say, well, we were fortunate, the department estimated us too low, and we've just gained a competitive advantage over the people in the same business. So this is the situation. And 5 years ago, we approached an association that represents industries, and we said, this is a problem for us, and what can we do about it? And let's advance a bill. And they said, well, let's work on it. Maybe we can do some education. So we worked with them. We developed an education program. The success increased a little bit, and then it's gone back to where it was. So we approached the association again and met with the representatives from AOI, Associated Oregon Industries, and they said, well, we're fine with this time because we've tried to work it out. I do have a chart in your handout that's not intended to be a statistically significant chart. It's just the raw data, what happened. And for the industrial taxpayers for 2002, you'll see in the non-filers, there's 110 out of 1,200 for 9.2%. And it's just interesting to note that 75% of those are chronic. So it's just happening all the time. So that's the second point, and really that covers the two points I wanted to make in the bill. Is one, give us the ability to reduce these penalties when we think it might improve the situation, and two, to bring the other penalty for industrial taxpayers up to what the centrally assessed taxpayers pay currently. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for John Phillips. Interestingly, comparing those two, I see the noncompliance rate for the centrally assessed is 2.9% and 1.7%, substantially lower than the industrial.
That is correct, Mr. Chair, and that's why we think we're having more success.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
Yeah, Mr. Phillips, would it be the same across the board for the centrally assessed and industrial in terms of the other piece of this bill that gave you some ability to flex with situations on the centrally assessed? Is that the same provision for this industrial?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, this bill does not do that. Okay. And the reason why it doesn't is because industrial taxpayers appeal directly to the Board of Property Tax Appeals, which is a local board you're probably familiar with. And that board has the ability to reduce or waive. So that already exists.
Okay.
Good question.
Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Phillips, let me ask you a question. If I'm an industrial taxpayer, when do I know that my taxes are going to be due in March and April? Do I know that in September?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, when your taxes will be due?
Uh-huh.
Yes. Every taxpayer
or the filing
should know that the taxes are due on November 15th.
Mm-hmm. But this deals with the filing.
I'm sorry. I worded the question. I
misunderstood you.
No, you didn't misunderstand it. I worded it wrong. The filing that we're talking about here. When do I know that that filing has to take place in the spring?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I would venture to say that all companies know, unless they're a brand new company to Oregon, that the filing deadline would be March 1st. We're in contact with them, and every year we send them their last year's filing so that they know, so that they can edit it and let us know what's changed.
So these 85 non-filers simply aren't going to want to file. Is that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, a good example of that would be a week before last, a very large company in the Valley called and said that they wouldn't be filing when they said that the $250 just didn't, I mean, it wasn't an issue for them with the time that they might have to put into the actual processing of the penalty. And a couple of the valuation staff that work in our floor came over and said, you've got this bill, and here's a prime example of, you know, someone who's just ignoring us. And so they are aware of it in some cases, but I wouldn't say in all cases. I know there's probably some situations where companies are not aware or inadvertently, for whatever reason, perhaps good and sufficient cause, in which case their appeal can be to the board, and then they have been and are reduced.
But this is an annual statutory filing date, like April 15 for income tax returns?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, okay.
That's correct.
Representative Barnhart and then Hatz.
Are you saying that there are some companies that simply never file a return at all?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, yes. It's very similar, I suspect, to income tax, where if you don't file your income tax return, and I'm not an income tax person, but I'm told that the income tax auditors will assert a value and then bill you for that.
Well, a follow-up question. I mean, for a very large company, the maximum penalty here may be less than the cost of preparing the return. I'm wondering if the maximum penalty ought not to be higher than this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart.
So that from a business standpoint, the penalty costs more than actually following the law.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, yes, that could work in that direction. I think we would like to see the penalty increased to match the centrally assessed penalty and then evaluate it. And we try to have a very good working relationship with the people, the tax representatives for the companies, generally, I mean, in the most part, you see we have some pretty good success, but there are some chronic non-filers.
Thank you. That was pretty much my point, too. The parking tickets in Portland used to be $5, and it made more sense to just sit there and get parking tickets than to go into a garage, and then they raised the rates to 18 or 16, and so, I mean, in principle, I think, as Representative Barnhart noted, is probably holds true.
Yeah. And I assume that the department can be trusted not to hit an ice cream stand with a $25,000 penalty if they don't file. That would be reserved for big companies. One
right.
of the rooms.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, we would only hit the very big companies with that. No. actually, the limit is $5,000.
Today?
Yeah. Yes.
Thank you.
And I do want to clarify, if I've in any way said that there's companies out there that, you know, that most companies, I don't want to paint all companies this way. One of the reasons I think the Association of Oregon Industries, for example, you know, is not opposing this is because they represent companies that file, and they want people to file, and it's in their best interest to file.
All right. Any other questions for Mr. Phillips? Thank you, John. Anybody else wish to speak on House Bill or Senate Bill 230? All right, let's close the public hearing. I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 230. Much pleasure.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hatz.
I would move Senate Bill 230 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Hatz moves Senate Bill 230 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? All right, Kathy, please call the roll.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Berger.
Aye.
Barr.
Aye.
Taft.
Aye.
Hobson.
Aye.
Pratt.
Aye.
Berger.
Aye.
Williams.
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 230 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Who wants to carry? How about down on this end? Anybody?
Hello.
Berger? All right. Representative Berger will get this one. Close the work session on Senate Bill 230. Dick, did we get an answer back on HR 7? They would like to see the bill. All right.
The reason being is like the university construction budget.
Oh.
In terms of reviewing that and also in terms of debt service.
Okay. So the answer is Ways and Means would like to see SJR 7. Let me return to work session on that then. Reopen the work session on SJR 7. Then the motion would be to the floor of the due pass recommendation with subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
So moved.
Representative Berger moves SJR 7 to the floor of the due pass with subsequent to Ways and Means. So it goes there on the way. Is there any discussion on that motion? Okay, please call the roll.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Berger?
Aye.
Barr?
Aye.
Pass?
Excused.
Hobson?
Aye.
Pass?
Aye.
Berger?
Aye.
Williams?
Aye.
Berger?
Aye. Senate Bill SJR 7A goes to Ways and Means Committee then. Hope we see it back out of there soon. Close the work session on SJR 7. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 858. Thank you, Dick.
You're welcome.
Mesa.
It's good to be back, Mr. Chair.
Good to see you again. Missed you.
Likewise.
Likewise.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 858 also comes from the Senate Revenue Committee, also passed the floor of the Senate, and it was amended once in the Senate. And this bill primarily deals with the issue of the enterprise zones. Those are the short-term enterprise zones where they get, if they qualify, 3 years exemption from property taxes with an option to extend that to 5 years under certain criteria. And the bill basically changes some of the qualification that will allow the companies to get that exemption. It changes the level of income and capital investment to about 20 million and then allows the sponsoring local government to change the set numbers of the increases in employment and refine that and give it an ability for the company to re-qualify under this new level of investment that is capital incentive.
What changes would be made to the minimum employment requirements? In other words, there's a certain level. Who would determine how many jobs it would create in the enterprise?
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, the statute says that you have to have 10% from a certain base, 10% increase, or one if less than 10%, less than one, at least one. This is predicated basically on what you start with. What is the base that you're coming from to get to that 10%? The bill, what it is saying, if you have a certain level of capital investment that is big enough, which is 20 million at this point, the local sponsor could go back and readjust that level of from where you started with. So if you have the beginning or the initial application, you said you have 1,000, then you'd have to increase by 10%. That's, you know, 100 new employees now. But this says if you have invested $20 million at least, then the sponsor could go back and readjust that base, that 1,000 you started with, down.
We'll get some testimony on that. Okay. Follow up on that as well. Yeah.
Right. And Mr. Chair, this will eventually have impacts in the tune of about $750,000 a year for the 5 years that we see in the fund for the enterprise zones. We think that there's enough window for one company more than the sponsoring or the asking company to slide through this window. Now, we have also a dash two amendments, and these amendments just been produced, and what they intend to do is allow the company that has paid because of these statutory requirements that the counties have to go through and send the tax bill for the tax year 2003, which starts, as the bill says, from July 1st, 2002 to June 30th, 2003. If the payment has been made, then this Dash 2 amendment allows for a refund of that payment.
Okay. Well, we'll get some testimony on that, too. let's bring up Jack Benton and Larry Glass. You bet you can. That's yours.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Betsy Earls. I'm with the law firm of Harang Long, Gary Rudnick, and I am representing today one of our clients, Sumco Oregon Corporation. Sumco has had some employee headcount issues with a subsequent investment that they have made in their South Salem property, and Mr. Benton is here to talk with you a little bit about how those have worked and affected their company.
This is relative to the bill in print in chief for the Dash A2s, both? To both, okay.
Mr. Chairman and members of the House Revenue Committee, for the record, my name is Jack Benton. I'm Vice President General Affairs for Sumco USA Corporation. General Affairs is a term that describes my job duties. Basically, my job duties are those jobs that nobody else wants to do.
That's why you're here this morning.
That's right.
That's why I'm here this morning. I also, for the record, I do want to thank Senator Winters for being just outstanding in terms of our supporting our and I also would like to say thanks to the City of Salem for its ongoing support of our organization. SB, Senate Bill 858 is a rather narrowly described bill to accommodate an unusual occurrence that affects our company and just a few others, we think. But to understand SB 858, you need to know a little bit about Sumco Oregon Corporation, which I've provided you a handout, and I would like to refer to that handout in terms of some important information. In reference to the chronological history of Sumco Oregon, I think it's on the second page of your handout. The important dates are 1982, when predecessor companies came to Salem, Oregon. And from that date, there's been a significant amount of investments made. And there are key dates for those investments. In 1996,
we got a class of school kids coming in. Could you make your testimony more exciting?
At my age, that was very difficult. This is rather dry material. But the product we make is very exciting. So 1996 was a pivotal date in terms of our investment history, and another key date is the year 2000, which in fact is where we are today with SB 858. We have invested since 1982 around $750 million in equipment and property in the city of Salem, an enormous investment. SB 858 only refers to a minor component that we made in 2000 and 2001 of just below $50 million. So the investment we've made in Salem is significant, and that investment is now coming to fruition in terms of property tax. The other key point that I want to make is that in the last 4 years, Sumco Oregon Corporation has lost around $250 million. So our ultimate survival is tenuous. So it's important that we're trying to manage our our overall cost structures in order to maintain a viable entity, and that's the essence of 858. In your handout, I also provided a pictorial picture of both of our campuses located in Salem, one in South Salem, the other in North Salem. South Salem is the newer facility, and I believe some of the representatives here today have been able to see some of our plants, and that's been very appreciative. I think the presentation is on the headcount. So if you can refer to that, I'll try to take you through that, and I think this may answer a previous question. We have a historical reference point of the headcount of our investment in Salem since 1990. We reached a high headcount in the year 2000, which in terms of the cyclical nature of this business is when our plants were at close to full capacity. That's the year, too, that we made investments, and we submitted for qualification on enterprise zone status. That baseline essentially establishes where we would begin our headcount requirement, and in this case, it would be a 10% increase upon that. So where we were for our pre-certification status was 1,337 employees. And 10% on top of that required that we maintain headcount of 1,140 employees. So that's how the enterprise zone statute works in terms of investments. It's important, too, though, that at the time of pre-certification, if you make an investment of more than $25 million, you can also ask the sponsor to waive that headcount requirement. Now, we did not do that when we applied for our pre-certification status. We felt that, and we believed our forecast, that business was going to be up and not down, and so we did not apply for the waiver, although we did make an investment in excess of $25 million. The beginnings of 2001 was a catastrophic event in terms of the semiconductor industry. 2001 is the time that the industry collapsed.
Who noticed?
and
we
have not recovered. This is now 2003, and we're still struggling with trying to recover from that very disastrous period. The way we can deal with our costs is our business is that we have no basic control on price. We have a lot of
control on costs, and that we try to manage our cost. And the most large cost is obviously labor. And because of the significant downturn in the industry, our headcount dropped dramatically. And as you can see, pictorially now, from the high point, we are now down below 800 employees. And as the existing statute of the enterprise zone statute exists today, that would disqualify us. What Senate Bill 858 does, in fact, is allow the sponsor, in this case the City of Salem, to waive the headcount requirement based on the fact that we've made an investment in excess of $20 million. I also have attached to the handout a letter that I sent to Senator Decker in reference to some concern raised by the AFL-CIO. I wanted to refer to that to say that it is SUMCO Oregon's intent to stay in the City of Salem. We're committed to that, and we would be willing to commit to the City of Salem a minimum headcount requirement going forward. So I want to assure you that our objective here is to maintain an active business enterprise in the City of Salem. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Do you want to speak to the Dash A2s? That adds another element.
Yes, the amendment that was being proposed today is a technical issue around what is now the time frame of the actual, assuming that this bill reaches enactment and gets approved, that the time frame of that enactment would come after certain tax due dates would be occurring. So what we're trying to clarify for this year is that any taxes paid that are affected by Senate Bill 858 that would, because it had not been enacted, would be refunded to us. Just for this year, I want to make clear.
Okay, I was going
to
add that it's just for this year. Well, this bill's in process. Okay.
We did make a payment last September to the sponsor, Mr. Chair, that we are not asking refund for.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Park.
Thank you. As far as you know, is SUMCO the only company statewide that's affected by this?
Mr. Chair and Representative Farr, as far as I know, there is no other specific company mentioned. I do believe there potentially may be one and as many as five.
The last paragraph of the staff measure summary. This is unclear yet how many firms might be impacted at this point. The initial information seems to suggest that the number is less than a handful.
So
is that you, Mason?
Yes.
I can tell.
Yeah.
Four or fewer.
Sure.
Representative Hess.
I was one of those legislators who went over on that tour, and to me this... I'm taking a wild guess, but I bet you wish you weren't here, and I bet you wish there wasn't the need for this bill.
Yeah.
And it feels like one of those things where pragmatism would say, would suggest that this is one thing you do to keep this kind of industry alive, because this is the kind of economy that we're trying to build. And, you know, it's just what I think it's the kind of thing that you would do to get away from this reputation. We keep hearing these horror stories about the government wouldn't do this or wouldn't do this, and this just feels like a pragmatic solution to helping the kind of industry that we want in the state run through a tech wreck. Just makes some sense.
I agree.
Yeah.
Talk about attracting business. It's important to retain the businesses that we've got. Representative Barnhart?
Thank you. This is a technical question, I think. And so I'm not sure who I'm directing it to exactly, but it appears from a quick review of the bill and the bill history that the dash twos put back what the dash ones took out. That's not right. Okay, good. I'm glad I asked the question.
Yeah. It's a good question.
Mr. Chair and Representative Barnard, I let me clarify for that. No, this is the original bill, as it was drafted, contemplated a refund of the payment that was made in 2002. That was not our intent, by the way. Then this clarification is just limited specifically to any payment made in this year.
Ah, I see. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Larry Glassick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Larry Glassick. I am the president of SEDCOR, the Salem Economic Development Corporation, and I'm also the manager of the Salem Enterprise Zone. I would certainly encourage you to pass out 858 as amended, just to not to repeat some things here. Actually, I heard clearly what Representative Haas said, and I didn't even feel my lips move, so don't have to repeat that. But my history with this, as some of you may know, I've been in the economic development business in Oregon and in the Salem area since 1974, and worked with all the predecessors to SUMCO to locate them here, and then as well as their purchase by Mitsubishi in the mid-60s, and then their expansion in the 1990s. And I want to assure you that Mitsubishi would have not been here, and that enormous investment would have not been made had it not been for the existence of the Enterprise Zone. It was very critical to all of their decisions here. Their investment in the 1990s was the largest single private sector investment in the city of Salem. And I don't think it will be equaled in the very near future, given the economy. Not only are we active in the recruitment business, but also in the retention business. And certainly SUMCO has been literally drawn through the keyhole here over the last several years, and we need to be receptive to their needs and what happens in this business over the years. I think just then the bottom line is what you're doing here is not changing too much. The authority for granting this still is vested within the local community. So it really goes back to them, and it's up to the company to make their case before the community. So I'd urge you to pass this out.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Glassick? Representative Barnhart?
Actually, Mr. Chair, I have another question for Mr. Benton, if I may.
That's fine.
Sir, are some of your products sold to other companies in Oregon for further manufacturing, in addition to other places?
Mr. Chair and Representative Barnhart, our product is sold. Our product is a silicon wafer, and it is the base material used in the semiconductor. And our key customers would be somebody like Hewlett Packard. We sell to Hynix, we sell to Motorola, Intel, Fairchild, International Rectifier. It's important, I think, important point I'd like to make is that the dynamics of our business is that in year 2000, the revenues produced by the semiconductor industry, not including the silicon wafer industry, was $600 billion. The silicon wafer industry, which was our product, is $6 billion. So we're really a minor component of the overall semiconductor industry, and enormous leverage comes down on our industry in terms of price. We're crushed. But we have worldwide product.
Further questions? Representative Berger?
Yeah, I feel I'd like to make a comment here. In Mr. Benton's chronology, you'll note that they came to Salem in 1982. Those of us that have been around remember 1982. We'd just gone through a nightmare such as we are now experiencing. And it was a significant and the event to have this company start investing in Salem, and they have made a huge investment I think we need to be here to help our friends again, because they were certainly friends to ours, a predecessor company at that time.
All right. Thank you very much. Does anybody else wish to testify on Senate Bill 858?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Barr.
The fiscal statement doesn't include the refund contained in the...
Do you want to address that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barr, this refund would be in the year 2003, which means it would be for this biennium, current biennium that we're in now. Mm-hmm. In the revenue impact, we were addressing next biennium or the biennium after. We could most certainly do the mentioning of the additional 2003 amounts that would be with the refund.
But again, to clarify, I guess any revenue impact on local government would be based on local government approval of,
that's correct,
of this amendment to the agreement. So it would be something we're not imposing, but something that they would encounter.
That's absolutely correct.
Okay.
Thank you, Ms.
All right. Any other questions? Another school group. Where are you guys from?
West Lynn.
West Lynn. Welcome to the Revenue Committee. Anybody want to testify on Senate Bill 858? We can't tell you. John Phillips. I'm kidding.
But John will tell you.
Yeah. That's right.
You're not smart though.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. I just saw the dash twos this morning quickly, and I wanted to say that we don't have a problem with them. But as a practical matter, the property has not yet been disqualified for the 2002-2003 tax year. So what we would be doing, we're waiting for this bill. We would disqualify them under this bill. We would disqualify them, then they would pay the tax, then they would pay the penalties and interest, then the county would, then they would apply to the county to refund, the county would refund.
Right.
As a practical matter, it seems reasonable to me that we would not do anything.
Are you suggesting a different amendment?
I don't want to do that because it's not our intention to hold the bill up, but we'll be thinking about a way to do that without creating a lot of work for everybody.
Couldn't you do that administratively? I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Couldn't you do that administratively, John?
I'm trying to think on my feet and see of a way that we could do that, and we would do everything we could to do that administratively. I mean, it only makes sense.
Right.
The refund would apply to penalties and interest as well, wouldn't it? So we're just talking about...
having a whole bunch of people have to go through hoops.
Exactly it.
Right.
They
could just give you a blank check and you could carry that.
Sure. So we'll be working on that and with the company, but that's...
Did somebody say Dexter?
we just thought Dexter.
Dexter, are you here? Okay.
How about that? Help Dexter.
Dexter Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members, good morning. Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council Office. One way, and I have been thinking in the middle of the night that I probably should have done this in the first place, is to put a line in here that if taxes have not been paid, they shall be abated. And that should take care of that.
Question then for us is, shall we wait to work? Is this on? Did I put this on the schedule for tomorrow, too? I wasn't sure. So the question is, shall we wait for tomorrow to move this, or are you comfortable making that a conceptual amendment?
I'm comfortable.
You're comfortable with that?
Let's do it.
Okay, is the committee inclined? Of course, we're not in work session yet. I don't want to rush anything here, but it seems to me we've got a pretty strong consensus to do this. All right, let me close. Does anybody else want to testify on Senate Bill 858? Let me close the public hearing and open a work session then. And looking at first at the dash, are you okay with this?
I am. Okay. I just wanted Dexter.
Yeah, Dexter, if you could give us where
exactly
that conceptual amendment would go.
The conceptual amendment.
Side commentary, Mr. Chair, for our students from West Lynn. This is really how it works. You see, we're he's writing the law as we're sitting here at the table getting ready to vote on it. So it's
kind of scary, isn't it?
This is under the heading of making it up as you go along, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so what school in West Lynn?
Martin.
Pardon?
What school in West Lynn?
This is West Lynn Middle School in Corvallis.
Oh, West Lund. Oh, I'm sorry, you said West Lynn. Okay, it's West Lund. It's Corvallis.
Is it called West Lund?
West Lynn, up by Portland, yeah. But this is W-S-T-L-U-N-D.
Oh, yeah,
oh, that's right. L-A-N-D. Didn't you have some kids here yesterday, too?
Yes,
yeah.
All week.
Oh, it's all week. Okay.
Is it subsection? Are your constituents?
No, not my constituents, unless I live out in the country. Could be. How are we doing there, team?
One of mine.
So you guys have the rare opportunity of actually watching a law being written.
It's
pulse-pounding excitement.
You know, we should, this is kind of like a baseball for those people on the internet. We should describe the action. The furious scribbling at the witness desk here, and it's a home run down the left the third baseline. Okay, what do we have next?
Okay. After line 17 of the Dash A2 amendments, insert subsection 4.
Mm-hmm.
If property taxes, interest, and penalties described in subsection 1 of this section have not been paid, such amounts shall be abated, period.
Okay. Can I have a motion to that effect?
Mr. Chair, I so move. Are we in work session?
We are.
Mr. Chair, I move the conceptual amendment.
Yeah, okay. Okay, Representative Williams moves the conceptual amendment
to the Dash 2.
To the Dash A2. A2 amendments to Senate Bill 858, inserting after line 17, and Dexter, just to make sure I got this back right, a new subsection 4, if property taxes, interest, and penalty described in subsection 1 of this section have not been paid, comma, I assume, such amount shall be abated. Okay. All right. Is there any discussion on that conceptual amendment? All right. Any objection? The conceptual amendment to the A2s is in. Representative Williams?
Mr. Chair, I move the A2 amendments as conceptually amended into House Bill 858.
Senate Bill. Representative Williams moves the Dash A2 amendments as conceptually amended to Senate Bill 858. Is there any discussion on that motion? All right. Hear any objection? Hearing none. So ordered. Representative Williams?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 858 as amended, including the conceptual amendments, to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williams moves Senate Bill 858 as amended by the Dash A2s, including the conceptual amendments, to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on that motion? All right. Please call the roll.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Berger?
Aye.
Farr?
Aye.
Cass?
Aye.
Austin?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Berger?
Aye.
Williams?
Aye.
Chair Shiloh?
Aye. Senate Bill 858 as amended. We'll go to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Representative Berger, we already gave you one today, but it seems to me you ought to have this one. This is
yeah, I'm carry two. I don't mind.
Okay, anybody object to
unless
that?
Unless somebody wants.
Not at all.
All right. You guess not. Then Representative Berger will carry Senate Bill 858. Thank you. All right. Now let's go to the tobacco wars. Stick around for this one. It'll get good. House Bill 2368. I'll open a work session on that. Welcome back, Dick Yates. Dexter, are you here on 2368, too? I saw you. Dexter, are you here on 2368, too?
Only a
team. Oh, okay.
Okay. We have none.
All right, Dick, if you could bring us up to speed on Senate or House Bill 2368.
Mr. Chair, Dick Yates, Legislative Revenue, members of the committee. House Bill 2368 essentially deals with cigarette tax law compliance and also compliance under the other tobacco products tax laws. The bill itself, which you should be dealing with the corrected Ingross bill, deals with clear that the consumer of the product is ultimately liable for the tax. This was not clear in the case of other tobacco products, or was not the case in the case of other tobacco products. Bill also increases penalties, and then the bill was amended in the prior committee to include some sections on delivery sales, which primarily address internet sales, but also mail order sales. We have a number of amendments to the bill. The ones that are still alive, essentially, A5, dealing with common carriers, and so far as I'm able to determine, there's no, among the parties who are interested in this bill, there's no disagreement with that amendment.
I'm kind of looking for nods of the head affirmatively or okay otherwise. All right.
We have the A6 amendments, which were changing the delivery sales as they were in the A and gross bill. Those have now been replaced. We have the A7 amendments, which we heard yesterday for the first time, and those I had replaced.
So A7s are no
A7s
longer
are out.
Okay.
So that brings us to the A8 and 9, which are two amendments that came out this morning, which address delivery sales. And we could take a minute and sort of go through just the difference of those two before you begin to. This is sort of an either or choice.
Okay, Dick, do the A8s and 9s both incorporate the A7s?
The A7s are dead.
They're dead.
You have the A10s, which replace the A7s.
I haven't
gotten to those yet.
Do we have A10s?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Everyone but the chair.
All right, keep going. I'll find mine. Okay.
Okay, briefly then, to go through the A8s and A9s, basically we have questions here of concern between the non-participating manufacturers under the Master Settlement Agreement and basically the major tobacco producers who are party to those agreements. If you move to page 3, subsection 6 on line 8, you see the difference there. In the dash 9 amendment, persons who are distributing or selling cigarettes or other tobacco products through a delivery system are required to comply either with the tobacco statutes in the dash 9, which the site there, ORS 320305 to 482 is the cigarette tax law. 500 to 640 is the other tobacco products. So they're required to comply with those provisions of law. In the dash 8 amendments, it's broader. They're required to comply with all other laws of the state. And I presume the main difference there is the qualifying statute under the that's part of the Master Settlement Agreement. On page 8 of the bill, then, of the amendment, both amendments, you find section 82. And again, in the dash 9 amendments, authority there is given only to the Attorney General to bring action to enforce the provisions of this act. And in the dash 8 amendments, you have includes any person that holds a permit issued under section 5713 of the Internal Revenue Code to engage in business as a manufacturer or importer of tobacco products. So it gives the sort of civil rights degree.
We don't have okay, page eight. Just the critical page.
Okay, no,
we do not have page eight of the dash A8 amendments.
No paycheck.
Right.
Guess we can't move them. But go ahead. I think we understand. Go ahead and explain that. I think we understand what we're going to be looking at.
So the question is, with respect to this act, who has authority to enforce it, whether it's just the Attorney General or whether, in a civil sense, other people related to this industry have the authority to bring it forth.
Okay.
Now, then,
which is which?
The A...
Nine.
The A9s would create the A8s would create the
broader
private attorney general kind of enforcement.
If I understand it, the A8s are broader in both areas.
That's correct.
And the 9s are narrower in both areas.
Correct. Okay, before I quit, the dash 10s. Now, the dash 10s replace the dash 7s, and the objective here is to provide for funding of the task force out of the cigarette tax and other tobacco products taxes. The A7s addressed only the 58-cent cigarette tax, so that would affect the distributions of the of the proceeds, and the intent was to have the full $1.28 tax support these activities. Okay. And so the amendments now in the A-10 provide that all of those cigarette taxes are sort of proportionately responsible for these costs.
Okay. Are the -A-10s a consensus amendment?
I believe so.
They're not part of the war.
Yes,
effort.
I believe that.
Okay. Well, all right, Representative Barnhart.
Well, just to make sure I understand, then the effect of this is to apportion the enforcement costs over all of the recipients of various pieces of the tax. Is that right, or am I missing
well,
the point?
Well, that is the effect. My understanding in talking with Ways and Means is that it is their intent to hold the health plan harmless, so there would be other revenues that would replace the lost cigarette tax revenues so far as the health plan is concerned.
But that's outside of this bill.
That's outside of
okay,
this.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. All right, then I think maybe, committee, if you recall, when we heard this a few days ago, or was it last week? I can't remember. Yeah, it was last week. I asked the work group if they couldn't come to an agreement to give us alternative versions, and that's what they've done. So we'll bring them up to testify. But I think just to keep us focused and keep this thing, keep us from getting lost in these amendments, what I'm inclined to do would be to move adoption of the A5s and the A10s just to. So we don't lose sight of those. Anybody have a problem with that? Okay, the chair would move adoption of the A5 amendments to House Bill 2368 then. Is there any discussion on that motion? Any objection? All right, they're in. And the chair would move adoption of the A10s to House Bill 2368. Is there a discussion on that amendment? Any objection? Okay, they're in. All right, now we are to the crux of the issue, which are the A9s. Have you said your piece? Should we?
Yes.
Okay.
We do have from the Attorney General's office.
Yeah, let's start with Pete Shepard. Pete, if you want to come up. Are these more Westland kids? Huh? Arriving just at the pitch of the battle.
Westland is the one who makes the payments.
You? Who does? Oh, okay. That's okay.
Pete just went
out. Okay. All right. Pete Shepard.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General, and at the request of the chair, we did convene a work group and arrived at the consensus on the A5 and A10 amendments and developed the two alternatives, the A8s and A9s, for your consideration today. Let me briefly just add to what Mr. Yates has described in terms of the effect of the and comparison between the A8s and A9s by way of explaining the Department of Justice position that we do not object to the A8s, but we think the A9s do substantially everything that the state needs to do by way of adding to these enforcement tools.
Okay, let me get that again, just keeping score here. A8s, okay. A9s, better. That's DOJ's position.
Mr. Chair, the DOJ's position is, again, that we don't object to the A8s, but
yeah.
the A9s, it seems to us, are adequate for the reasons I'll describe to you in a moment.
Okay.
To do what the state needs to do at any rate under these circumstances.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, just to clarify, let me say it a different way, and you tell me if you agree with this. The A9s and the A8s each do everything that the state wants. One of them does a little more in another area that you're not as interested, that you're less concerned about.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, that's correct. The A8s are not necessary from the state's standpoint because the A9s are sufficient, but we don't object to the A8s.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I need to give you just a little bit more background about the non-participating manufacturer statute. In order to explain why it is that we think the A9s are adequate from the state standpoint. And that statute came about as a result of the master settlement agreement between the states and the tobacco companies, major tobacco companies. The master settlement agreement imposes restrictions that are aimed to protect the public health against certain marketing practices, and also imposes on participating manufacturers burdens to make payments to the state. The combination of those burdens under the Master Settlement Agreement obviously imposed some economic burdens on participating manufacturers. And so it is in the state's interest to level that economic playing field so as to encourage other manufacturers to join in the Master Settlement Agreement.
Excuse me, Pete, word is obviously getting out that this is the this is the place to be. Down the hall, the word is bad. Pete Shepard is testifying in revenue. Let's get there.
Mr. Chair, that's very flattering, but I'm sure it's not the reason.
Go ahead, sir.
So in order to level that economic playing field and thus to eliminate any disincentive for manufacturers to stay outside the framework of the Master Settlement Agreement, the state adopted, as 50 other states did, 49 other states, I think, adopted the non-participating manufacturer statute, the NPM law. And your staff has accurately referred to it as the qualifying statute. And the purpose of that law, the requirement of that law is that if you choose not to participate in the Master Settlement Agreement and you're a manufacturer of tobacco products, cigarettes, you're required to deposit into an escrow account an approximation of the same amount of money that you would have had to pay if you joined the Master Settlement Agreement.
Thank you.
So the state has a strong public health interest and a strong fiscal interest in seeing that non-participating manufacturers comply fully with that statute. And indeed, in Oregon, we've done everything we can to diligently enforce that NPM statute. A separate bill that has made its way so far successfully through the process and has recently been approved by the House Judiciary Committee, House Bill 2094, adds enforcement tools to the arsenal of remedies that the state has for non-compliant, non-participating manufacturers, those not NPMs who do not comply with the NPM statute. And it's important to keep that in mind because it illustrates why there is not as much a difference between the A8 and the A9 amendments as you may perceive initially. There are two aspects of the apparent difference between A8 and A9 that I think go away when you consider them in relation to House Bill 2094. And they both of those aspects pertain to the hypothetical of an NPM that is not compliant with the qualifying statute, not making the required escrow deposits. Under 2094, that NPM manufacturer is forbidden, first of all, must be a distributor and cannot become a distributor for purposes of Oregon law unless it brings itself into compliance with that statute. And under both sets of amendments you have before you, the bill in front of you, 2386, under either the A8 or the A9 statutes, a person is in violation of that if they distribute products and they are not a distributor. Therefore, as to a non-compliant NPM manufacturer, the effect of 2094 combined with even the A9 amendments is the same as, in my judgment, the A8 amendments. So as to that piece of the hypothetical, you get to the same result with the A9s plus 2094. There's a second feature of the apparent difference between the A8s and the A9s that also goes away when you take into account, or substantially goes away when you take into account the hypothetical of a non-compliant NPM, and that has to do with the private cause of action. Under House Bill 2094, a private cause of action is created for a competitor, a participating manufacturer, who is damaged in some way by a non-compliant NPM. And under 2094, there are two forms of private remedies that are available to a participating manufacturer. And those are, first, a private cause of action directly for non-compliance with the qualifying statute. That private cause of action is limited to injunctive relief and costs. So the participating manufacturer under 2094 can go to court and get an injunction from a court that says to a non-participating manufacturer, from this point forward, you shall not violate the law. And also, participating manufacturer can recover their costs. And the other piece in 2094 that's accessible on a theoretical basis, at least, to a participating manufacturer is access to a private cause of action under the racketeering law. And there, that private cause of action would require first criminal prosecution of the noncompliant manufacturer. But if that condition were met, then it would be possible for a participating manufacturer to bring a private civil action against a noncompliant manufacturer. Again, the A9s plus the provisions of 2094 that I described give a participating manufacturer a private cause of action that's a rough equivalent that to the one provided in the Dash A8 amendments, with one important exception, and that's the last piece, and this is where the A9s and the A8s are not the functional equivalent of one another. And that has to do with the hypothetical of a compliant NPM, because there 2094 wouldn't provide any remedy. And there, a compliant NPM that violates the delivery sales requirements would be subject to a private cause of action under the Dash 8 amendments, but not under any combination of 2094 and the Dash 9s. And that is the difference between the two, the remaining difference between the two. And as to that issue, there certainly are policy, it's policy choice for the legislature. At present, we think we're going to have some very good enforcement tools under the 2386 and the Dash 9 amendments, and we will have enforcement tools, as I've described, against noncompliant NPMs. And so at present, we don't see the need for adding a private cause of action to the enforcement tools that we'll have. As I say, we don't object to it. There are certainly other models where the legislature has provided private causes of action. No doubt you'll hear from that from my colleagues on the work group about why those are pertinent to your consideration.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Park.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I'm understanding you correctly, you're saying that the A9s plus 2094 equal the A8s other than in the case of a compliant manufacturer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Farr, that's my analysis of the bills. Okay.
So do either of the bills, or does either provision, the AA or 2094, allow a manufacturer to not sell product while the lawsuit is in process?
Mr. Chair, Representative Farr, I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, a question was raised to me that a manufacturer could sue another manufacturer for noncompliance, and while they were being sued, during the course of the suit, it would be prevented from selling product in the state of Oregon.
The injunctive ruling.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, Representative Farr, in most forms of civil action, the court will entertain a request for a preliminary injunction, in effect an order before there's a final judgment that requires a party to refrain from doing something or even to do something affirmatively. And I don't think there's anything in either 2094 or in either of the two sets of amendments you have before you that would prevent the litigant from seeking such an order. There's a fairly elaborate process for obtaining such an order and a showing that's required by the party that seeks it. So I don't perceive that there's anything in the Dash 8 amendments that automatically would require a company that's been charged but not yet judged to be in violation of those delivery sales rules to immediately cease action, though that would be something a party could seek from the court.
Okay. And one more question, if I may. How many other states grant enforcement authority for tobacco regulations to manufacturers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Farr, I don't know the answer to that question. There may be others who do.
There may or there may not, so you just...
I just, Mr. Chair, Representative Farr, I honestly just don't know one way or the other.
I never lost them.
You just got too technical, Pete.
I just didn't know the answer to that question.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my real question is whether the rest of the room cleared.
No, they're wrapped with attention. Representative Verger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is to get you to further clarify to me the non-participating manufacturer. In other words, we do have companies that are very reputable but did not participate in the mess, and so they're paying into the escrow of their compliance. they're all. And then we have Venezuela and Russia and people that are doing all kinds of stuff on gray and black markets. So I need to know, when you say non-participating manufacturers, does this include all the ghost good people and are all the black hat people?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I tried in my comments to distinguish between non-participating manufacturers who are compliant with Oregon law and those who are not. And as you say, there are people in both categories.
Yes.
I just want to understand. So the non-participating manufacturer that is non-compliant would include those, all of those who are illegally selling cigarettes into the state of Oregon. Okay.
Other questions for Mr. Shepard? On the injunctive relief, the state has the same ability to obtain preliminary injunction in a state enforcement action?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. We're eligible to apply for that. And,
okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Shepard. Bob Russell, did you want to come up, I think, before we get into the two sides on the A8s and 9s?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Russell. I'm president of the Oregon Trucking Associations, and I appreciate you calling me up first before you get into the controversy. I have one small remaining issue, and it's both in the A8s and the A9s. Dexter was asked to do a Herculean task by merging two different documents to create one, and the result was that there is a superfluous provision. And if you'll turn to page 5 on either one of the amendments, because it is in both. Section 78. And basically what this section deals with is the seller, what the requirements of the seller are in terms of transportation. And if you look at sub B, little b, it says, provide evidence of full compliance with Section 80 of this 2003 Act to the delivery service retained by the person. What Section 80 is the stamps on the bottom of the packages of cigarettes. There is no longer any purpose in this provision, since the delivery service is not responsible to make sure that the tax is collected, that the stamps are there. So, and quite frankly, it would be an impediment in terms of transportation. So if that little piece came out, then what the rest of it does is it says then the seller must use a delivery service that has the service available that verifies proof of majority at the time of delivery to the ultimate consumer. Which works just fine for us. We have all of those services available. So we would, in fact, be responsible once the seller requested it of us to actually get a signature and verify ID and make sure that these people were of age of majority when we delivered the cigarettes to the ultimate consumer. That's okay. But we really no longer have any role in making sure that the tax has been paid. I mean, that burden is on the seller. And so, I mean, if you think about this in practical terms, what would happen is they would have to actually show us the product, then put it into a package, and then hand it to us. And there's no purpose in that because there's nothing we would do except for look at it. So I would ask that one little provision come out as being superfluous, and if you chose to move it today, you could probably conceptually amend that, and that would be wonderful.
Okay, thank you.
Any questions?
Okay, then I would ask just questions for that.
Just a clarifying question to make sure I understand it. That takes the burden off the delivery service and places it on the seller.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Farr, the amendments do that.
Yeah.
Already. So there is no burden on the delivery service. All this does is says that the shipper has to show us the tax, the stamps on the bottom of the cigarettes for no purpose. because we no longer have the burden in the rest of the amendments. And it, quite frankly, it's just a function of trying to meld these multiple documents together, and we ended up with sort of a dangling provision is really what happened.
Dangling provision, I understand.
Okay. So as we hear any, as we hear further testimony on this, then, if either side has any problems with that, Dick?
I don't think that.
Okay, I was going to say, yeah.
Okay, actually, one more, just to make certain I understand.
Yeah.
Section 75 says what you're supposed to do, doesn't it, for a delivery sale? And that doesn't include make sure the tax is paid. Is that the point you're making? I'm looking at page two.
Right. Section 75 deals with the seller of the tobacco products. What Section 78 does is it also deals with the seller, but it tells them how they must ship the tobacco products. And in essence, what it's telling them is they have to use a transporter that will verify age of majority at the time they deliver to the ultimate consumer. And that's wonderful. We're happy to participate in that process.
Thank you.
Okay.
Pete Shepard from the AG. Okay, thumbs up from AG on deleting that particular provision of both amendments when we get to that. Okay. Who wants to go first? Come on up. Jim Gardner. You're on the A8.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner. I'm a partner with the law firm of Gardner & Gardner, and I'm appearing here today for Philip Morris. The policy choice I would suggest to you, represented by the difference between the A8s and the A9s, is an extremely important one. And I think, in large part, Pete Shepard characterized it accurately, though I want to go into some nuances in that difference in just a moment. But the way I would boil it down would be to say, does the state want to opt for the more aggressive enforcement tools available, which are the A8s, or do they want to settle for a less aggressive enforcement regime for the very important policy objectives that both amendments seek to further? Those policy objectives are, in essence, twofold, and it's important to stress what Mr. Shepard did not address, which is the key policy objective of the Internet sales provision is to protect minors from sales of tobacco. That's the key objective. A second objective is to protect state revenue. We now have credible estimates that perhaps up to 40% of all cigarettes consumed in the state of Oregon, and that number is growing, are either black market, gray market, contraband, untaxed, or otherwise not in accord with our laws. It's an enormous number, and it's a number that is kind of scary in terms of the risk posed to the state general fund, which has become heavily dependent both on the MSA revenue and the excise tax revenue. Those of you who have worked with me in another committee on the issue of Internet spam and how to address that know how difficult and how intractable some of these Internet policing issues are. And I think the thing that I have concluded from that exercise, which is equally applicable here, is that what you really need to do is to have a public-private partnership where the private sector is essentially enlisted as an ally of the state to help enforce these state policies. And that is where these two amendments differ. A8 would fully enlist and engage the private sector to enforce the laudable policies in both amendments, and A9 would not. The reason that this is important, and I want to again highlight what the key differences are in terms of the substantive provisions that are enforceable. Most of the substantive offenses that are contained in the A8s and the A9s are violations of provisions aimed at preventing internet sales of cigarettes to minors. That's the essence of it. And unless you adopt the A8s, the only enforcement resource you're going to have to protect minors in terms of internet sales is the Attorney General's enforcement authority. Let me repeat that. If you go with the A9s, you will not have the private sector as an ally to enforce the internet sales provisions that are aimed at protecting minors. That's the real difference. And when Pete was talking to you about the contraband statute and the injunctive relief about that, I think that's largely correct. But that doesn't address the key policy issue here, which is whether or not you want to bring every resource to bear, including the private sector, to enforce the protections as to minors. Now, why is that, as a functional matter, important? And it's very simple. For all their wonderful work, and I have nothing but praise for the Tobacco Enforcement Unit of the Department of Justice and Department of Revenue, we're actively supporting anything we can do to get those folks adequately funded. We did that last session. We remain strong allies. Their resources are limited. And as you can see from one of the handouts I gave you, which is a press release from Philip Morris about a project we worked on with the ATF, Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, we can augment those resources and those enforcement tools. We can, in fact, find and investigate and bring to justice those manufacturers located in Lithuania or Latvia or wherever it may be in a way that may be beyond the capacity of the Oregon Department of Justice. And we can work in partnership with them to do that. Now, what happens when we succeed in that effort? The state, I would suggest to you, benefits in two ways. First, the enforcement of the laws protecting minors from internet sales are enhanced and vindicated. But perhaps of some importance is the fact that the state benefits financially. If you turn to the page 7 of the A8s, you will see a fine structure there, a penalty structure, which is reasonably aggressive. And if the state of Oregon sues to enforce the provisions of the internet sales, the delivery sales law, the state general fund benefits from those fines. But likewise, if we sue to do the same thing, guess who benefits? The state general fund. So we can be not only your ally in enforcing the substantive provisions aimed at deterring internet sales to minors, but also enforcing the penalties to the benefit of the state general fund. Now, do we have a competitive motive for doing this? Absolutely. Absolutely. We want to see an even playing field where we can compete equally and continue to pay taxes and MSA money to the state of Oregon. You bet we have a competitive reason to doing that. But that's the very reason that this is in the interests of the state and the reason you can be assured that we will act vigorously to enforce this law. So I would suggest to you that the differences between the A8s and A9s in fact boil down to whether or not you want the private sector as your ally to enforce these important policies of deterring internet marketing and sales to minors and protecting state revenue. It's just that simple. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Farr.
Mr. Gardner, if I understood Mr. Shepard's testimony correctly, he said he was implying or suggesting that the House Bill 2094 pretty much allows that to happen, the allegiance to happen with the state without using the A8s. Do you disagree with that statement?
Mr. Chair, Representative Farr, yes, I do in this respect. The 2094s would give injunctive standing in terms of The NPM statute, which is the escrow statute, it has nothing to do with the safeguards as to minors under Internet sales. Nothing whatsoever.
Okay. Anything else? All right. Thank you, Jim. Marshall?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Marshall Kova, and I'm here this morning representing the Council of Independent Tobacco Manufacturers of America. And alongside me is Dave Redman. He's the president and CEO of Carolina Tobacco, which is a Portland-based NPM. CITMA is an association of complying NPMs in full compliance with the Master Settlement Agreement. And we support the intent of the bill in the regulation of Internet sales to minors. However, we bring to you and would suggest and encourage your support for the Dash 9s this morning. We believe the Dash 8s are a backdoor attempt to regulate NPMs and are similar amendments, if not the same amendments, that have been brought in state legislatures across the country. And as far as we are aware, none of them have been adopted to this point. And interestingly enough, they were even rejected in Virginia, the home state of Philip Morris, recently. I believe the differences in the bills have been very well illustrated by Pete Shepard, and the Section 6 on Section 76, we want to limit the enforcement as in the Dash 9s to the cigarette tax law. We believe that through House Bill 2368 and House Bill 2094, there is adequate enforcement of complying regulating law on the cigarettes. Not necessary to be so broad as suggested in the Dash 8s. This would get into, we believe, into the escrow provision, which is a very sensitive area, which has had a lot of discussion in Representative Williams' Judiciary Committee and this in House Bill 2094, which soon will be on the House floor. The differences in Section 82 allows the AG to bring the action to enforce the provisions of the bill. We believe this is adequate. And what it does in our minds, it precludes the major tobacco companies from litigating us into oblivion. And with those general comments, I would turn it over to Dave Redman. We urge your support of the Dash 9 amendments this morning.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm David Redman. I'm president and owner of Carolina Tobacco Company based in Portland, Oregon. And I'd like to take just a couple of minutes here to reinforce what Mr. Koba just said, the definition of a CITMA membership, that is the Council of Independent Tobacco Manufacturers of America. All due respect to the members here, to be characterized as foreign is not accurate. That all of the membership of our association, we are U.S. corporations, we're based here. Now, the bricks and mortar manufacturer may be overseas, but in our case, as a good example, and we are among the largest of the NPM price value companies in the United States, we have a bricks and mortar manufacturing overseas, but we are a U.S. corporation, and we are the legal manufacturer. We are the legal manufacturer. A comment about the Internet sales concept, Carolina Tobacco and CITMA is very much in favor of the 2068A9 and the 2094 combination. And in fact, we believed until just a few moments ago that the A9 was in fact a compromise among ourselves and major tobacco. The CITMA members are good corporate citizens. We're in favor of requiring the mail order internet sellers to affix an Oregon stamp to the cigarettes and to non-cigarette products to be in full compliance. We're in favor that the delivery system, whether it's internet or mail order, that they are in fact distributors, licensed distributors in the state. As far as Mr. Gardner's comments, I'd like to address a couple of those quickly and directly. I personally view that allowing big tobacco to be the enforcement against small business, which we are, is a bit of a vigilante concept.
And in A8, that's what it would allow. I'm completely comfortable, as is SIPMAR Association, with the Attorney General taking whatever course of action and whatever remedies are available. But I am not in favor, and neither is SIPMA, of the A8, which in fact opens the door for large companies to take legal action against small companies. And as we know, there are many examples where the amount of resources, financial and otherwise, with the large companies can just overwhelm a small company, can in fact bankrupt them. I therefore believe that A9, with the combination of 2094, will do everything that the state needs and requires for internet and delivery sales. Thank you.
Questions for either of these gentlemen? All right, thanks very much. Does anybody else want to be heard on the bill? Mark Nelson.
And Richard DeCosa saying.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson, representing RJR Tobacco. We're passing out some handouts, and I want to make Richard will talk and will address the issue of what is happening currently in terms of the tax collections in this state, or what I believe is the non-tax collections in this state as it relates to tobacco products. And then I want to talk address the A8s and A9s, and from the standpoint of what's really happening out there in terms of the marketplace. So, Richard, why don't we talk first generally about where we see what's happening with the leakage in terms of the dollars. And this is specifically related to this area in terms of this is one of the areas in which we are losing massive amount of revenue in this state. And I'll turn over to Richard, and then we'll come back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Richard Kosa, Sam Brown, Williamson.
Let me get Richard if you could bring the mic over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we have a couple of handouts. One is the Oregon Cigarette Tax Review, and it looks at tax collections from 95-96 fiscal year and going to estimates into the 03-04 fiscal year. Basically, what you'll see is a growth in collections, but not nearly commensurate with the tax increase. From 96 to 2003, cigarette tax, the excise tax in the state of Oregon, has gone up 236%. Your revenue change in the same period is approximately 90%. So the immediate question is, where does that lost revenue go? A lot of proponents or opponents of tobacco use have suggested it is directly attributed to decreased consumption. At about the bottom two-thirds of that page, you'll see smoking trends noted in Oregon. And if you rely on numbers through the Center for Disease Control, you'll see that from 96 to 2000, consumption in Oregon is relatively flat. So we don't lose the revenue in terms of decreased consumption. I think we need to turn to basically lost revenue. Mr. Gardner indicated that numbers would suggest that the state is losing somewhere between a third and maybe up to 40% of legitimate tax revenue. 2 years ago, we were before the Revenue Committee, and we had numbers that indicated that we thought at that time the state was losing approximately a third of legitimate tax revenue. If we take a look specifically at the internet component, nationwide estimates range that internet sales are 10 to 15% of all sales and growing. So if you would suggest that it is not a significant component, you take a look at the numbers. 10% in Oregon is the better part of $25 to $30 million a year. If you put it again in perspective, this is it's a tax issue, but directly, I think more importantly, it is a general fund issue to look at specifically with respect to the 03-05 budget. If the trends continue in Oregon, I think the projections will be drastically overestimated and receipts will be drastically underestimated for that period.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chairman, again, to echo what Richard has said, the Centers for Disease Control has basically, in the last 7 years, show a flat line on consumption in the state of Oregon. There has not been any significant reduction of consumption in the state. About 21%, and it's been in that range, of Oregonians smoke. In fact, we've had actually an increase in population in the state, so there are actually more people smoking, but the percentage of the total population is about the same. Again, you can see the massive leakage, which is not just from internet sales. It's from gray market, black market, Indian sales, and cross-border sales. The state of Idaho has a 27% tax on tobacco products. It doesn't take a giant intellect to figure out that if you bring a van of cigarettes from Idaho, with Oregon having the tax rate that it does, and they're having 27 cents, the amount of money that you can make per pack in terms of that interstate shipment, and it's happening as we speak. So in terms of this particular legislation and approaching the internet sales, the issue of NPMs is intertwined not just with the internet sales legislation you're seeing here today, but legislation that's also in the Judiciary Committee trying to regulate the non-participating manufacturer. The non-participating manufacturer is supposed to be paying into escrow an amount that is set by their as if they were selling their cigarettes in 46 states. And in Oregon, that amount is 1.14% of their sales. But in fact, what happens is two issues. Is one, the non-participating manufacturer, not the people who are up here today, but non-participating manufacturers, simply don't set up an escrow account. And they continue to sell tobacco products. They're changing brand names. They're changing their logos on a constant kind of basis. Another thing that they do is they move around the country. They're not selling in 50 states or 46 states. They're selling in maybe 4 states or 1 state or 6 states. And let me show you in the handout what happens when that occurs. And this example that we've given you that's titled Loophole in NPM Legislation. I'm using this example to talk about a bigger problem, but the same problem has to do with internet sales as well. Is let's make some assumptions. They sold a million packs of cigarettes in 2002. And they're only selling in a 4-state region, California, Idaho, Oregon, and Washington. And we've set percentages of those sales, and you can change those, but the impact is still the same. Let's say California 50%, Idaho 10, Oregon 20, Washington 20. They have an escrow account. They are, quote, legal in every state. And they've made the appropriate deposits in the state. Now, understand the escrow agreement and the NPMs. They put money into the escrow agreement. If they overpay, they get a refund. They can apply for a refund. It isn't automatic. They can apply for it. At the end of 25 years, whatever they have in that escrow account, they get back. Okay. So they get the money eventually back. But what happens here, okay, they paid their 27 cents, 1 million cigarettes, amounts to $270,000. But when you apply what they actually owe, the fact that they're only selling in that million cigarettes in 4 states, not 46 states, which participate in this agreement, okay, that $270,000, they get almost all of it back. And you see the calculation. In California, it's a 12% share. So they take the 12%. They only actually owe $34,000 in California. They only owe $980 in Idaho. $3,099 in Oregon, $5,543 in Washington. That's all they owe. So now they have overpaid because they're not selling in 46 states. They're only selling in 4. There is an amendment that will be discussed in the Senate side. It's called an allocable share amendment to fix this problem. Keep in mind that this whole NPM was set up as part of the master settlement agreement, to make sure that as the majors, the people who participate in that agreement and are making the payments to the states, that you didn't have other tobacco producers out there selling at a substantial discount because they don't have to pay for the master settlement agreement. So every state passed the MPM legislation that sets out their share. It doesn't take their money. It takes it into escrow. Gives it back to them after 25 years when the master settlement. So the marketplace is not disrupted. But as soon as the MPM does not participate, either in the escrow or plays this kind of scam, then you change the marketplace and you endanger the master settlement agreement and those payments. Now, testimonies have been given about big tobacco. Well, it's always big tobacco. This is about, are we going to protect those settlement agreements, and are we going to make the MPMs participate in as it was originally established? And they will argue, well, just because someone figured out the loophole and now selling four states, so they're jumping from state to state, we don't think it's fair for you to close that loophole. Well, we obviously very strongly disagree.
But Mark, the A8s don't close the loophole.
Well, but what the Attorney General has said, and he prefers the 9s, he will live with the 8s, but what the 8s do is, I give you this example to show you how big the picture is and how big the problem is. As it relates to the 10 to 13% of sales on the Internet, is you can come in and out of this state. You can be, quote, legal as it relates to the escrow agreement because of this kind of charade that could happen. But we believe that if you're violating the provisions of the delivery of sales, that this state, as Mr. Gardner says, needs every single piece of authority to go after those people. If they're violating this, our problem is the Attorney General isn't going to have problems. He isn't going to have the resources to go after every violation here. If they're violating it, they should be, and you have a private right of action, we can bring those people into court. And yes, there are resources of the tobacco industry that will do that. And we will be doing that to protect the master settlement agreement. Because for every cigarette that's sold in this state illegally, this state is one, not receiving their taxes, and two, it changes the formula, and we've already seen a shrinkage in the master settlement agreement to Oregon because of this kind of activity. Used to be 2% of cigarettes sold in this state were cigarettes sold by non-participating manufacturers. It's now 12 to 13. There's been an explosion of hundreds of these little companies who's taking advantage of that price differential. So whether you're talking about gray market, black market, or Internet sales, in this case, we believe the delivery of sales provisions here will help you enforce, and the stronger the enforcement, the better for the state, for taxes, and for the issue of distribution to minors.
Okay. We are out of time, which is fine, because I got a sense from committee that folks want to spend a little time puzzling over this. Come prepared tomorrow with a motion, somebody. That's on the agenda. We will get this out.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to part on the that revocable chair piece that the House Judiciary Committee punted and said they had to work that out in the Senate. So,
okay.
Chair.
Yes, Nick.
Direction.
Direction.
You seem to be considering a conceptual amendment. Would you like me, since we have a day, to get both of
Let's
these?
Let's do it. Then we wouldn't have to remember to do that. Sure. But tomorrow we'll have A11s and 12s.
There you go.
Okay. So thank you, everybody.
Just a reminder.
Close the work session. And what's that?
Thank you.
Needs to have a subsequent waste of means because of the A10 amendments, the issue of the department's budget.
All right, good. We're adjourned.